from the Washington Appellate Project here on behalf of Keenan Fastrup. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Three it is.
There are several unusual occurrences at Mr. Fastrup's trial that individually and considered cumulatively require a new trial. One thing that happened during jury selection was the bailiff apparently overhearing a conversation between Mr. Fastrup and his attorney. The particulars of this incident didn't come to light until later when the defense attorney filed a motion for a new trial explaining his perspective of what occurred.
Counsel, you say that the bailiff apparently overheard communication between counsel and client. I'm having a hard time with this record seeing that that's what happened. Explain it, please.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true. What happened on the record, the conversation between the court and the attorneys doesn't indicate exactly what happened, but what happened was off the record, and the defense attorney explained what happened from his perspective, from Mr. Fastrup's perspective, in his motion for a new trial. So the record that we have of jury selection certainly indicates something occurred with the bailiff communicating to the court, something that he or she noticed, but doesn't explain sort of the background of that.
So is it fair to say that there was a perception by the bailiff communicated to the judge?
The defense attorney's new trial motion explains that what he understands to have happened was that the bailiff actually overheard a private conversation that was in hushed tones.
The record shows.
The record shows that the bailiff communicated something to the judge, and the judge says, I understand from what I hear that you appear to have some relationship or recollection of this prospective juror, and let's explain the background of that. We need to know more about whether you know this juror or not.
Okay.
But the problem we have here is that we can't rely simply on that transcript we have from jury selection because that happened silently or off the records. And all we have here is what the defense attorney explained what happened. And then there was never any sort of evidentiary hearing or formal declarations from the parties, the bailiff, anyone to explain, in fact, what happened. The judge simply denied the motion for a new trial without comment, without an explanation of how she weighed that and what standards she used to decide that. And, you know, in the recent Peñafuentes case in the Supreme Court, the
state must have argued what the standard was for the new trial.
Yeah, the state didn't respond to factually what happened. Factually, we don't know.
But as far you said the court didn't articulate what the standard was, but I'm sure
the
prosecutor must have argued what the standard was.
The prosecutor filed a responsive motion, which largely said, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but if you said something in open court, then that's not privileged.
Well, but it must have also contained what the standard the court should follow for a new trial. We'll look.
I think so. I mean, it didn't. I don't think it probably had a sentence or two on that. The sub and substance of it wasn't really. Nothing really happened here. So, I mean, our argument here on appeal is that we have at least an unresolved issue, a defense attorney claiming something very serious happened that ended up chilling their relationship during trial because they had fears of communicating during court proceedings, and that was important to them during trial because the bailiff, who the defense attorney also says in his motion, was a prior law enforcement officer, apparently good at hearing things that were said quietly, and it chilled their relationship.
What was the timing of the motion for a new trial? When and did it come during, was it after the trial?
After the verdict. The initially, the motion for a new trial raised a number of issues, and then there were some follow-up motions from that. There's a CP 111 to 116 is the part of the motion for a new trial that explains the defense attorney's allegations or explanation about what happened, and also in CP 19 and 20 was a second motion to reconsider that ruling.
And when did the incident itself occur?
And that was it was a pre-trial incident when they were during jury selection. So it wasn't raised until after the trial.
Okay, and it was raised because of something that Mr. Fastrup told counsel?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was raised when I mean, I think the defense attorney was aware of what happened, presumably, during when it happened during jury selection, because the there's no reason to believe that.
Wouldn't that be the time to bring it up?
That certainly would have been a time to bring it up. And perhaps the defense attorney was waiting to sort of see how, if it had an effect on their relationship or whatnot, but he didn't raise it until then.
Waiting till after the verdict is a pretty long time to wait on something like that if you think you've got an a tainted juror. Or if you think there's been some kind of misconduct.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the taint of the juror itself, but it was
the effect on.
Well, at that point, I don't know how much more could have been done. I mean, they could have made a record saying, please don't listen to our private conversations. They're intended to be private. And that wasn't done.
Or they could have ascertained whether there actually was any ability to hear those conversations. I mean, who knows?
Yes. Yeah.
Based on this record, we don't.
We don't.
Other than what is submitted after the trial.
Yes, that's what the record shows. And since my time is running short, I'll just briefly say there was, on the other issue, sort of the large cumulative error discussions about the many occasions where Ms. Backstrom, the separately charged co-defendant who testified as the central state's witness, spoke about a lot of violent, dishonest, mean, threatening behavior of Mr. Fastrup toward her that happened outside of this incident, this charge incident. Some of which was objected to, not all of it which was, but considered together, it certainly is the type of evidence that would have affected the jury, especially in a case where he was convicted of a premeditated murder, and there's, from what seems like a very spontaneous argument that arose, and not the lesser of intentional murder, even if you believe that he was involved. So I think there's a basis to think that all that evidence together would have affected the jurors. Reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, unless you have questions now for me.
Thank you. 3 minutes remaining, correct?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. Amy McLean on behalf of the State of Washington. The record, as to the first issue that was discussed, the record contains no evidence whatsoever that there was any conversation that was overheard by the bailiff between Mr. Fastrup and his counsel.
Are you talking about the contemporaneous record?
Yes, but I would suggest that the post-trial record, the motion for a new trial that counsel raised after the verdict, after he waited and got an unfavorable verdict, there's no declaration from counsel that there was, in fact, a conversation. He refers generically to hushed conversation, but I think if you look at the contemporaneous record, it's quite clear that defense counsel has no idea what the court is talking about when the court brings it up. The court raised the issue. The court says specifically, okay, counsel.
Well, the bailiff raised the issue.
Not on the record, right? The first indication
I think we have to assume the bailiff raised the issue with the judge.
Yes, absolutely. So the first indication on the record we have is that the first time that it's brought up with the parties is what I'm referring to, because I don't believe that the bailiff brought it up with the parties. The court tells counsel, while we were on our morning break, my bailiff had come with some information to me. When juror 35 was brought in for individual questioning, she noted that Mr. Fastrup had demonstrated nonverbal recognition of juror 35, and so I wanted to inquire whether that was someone he was familiar with, and I'll just put that out there, Mr. Todd, defense counsel. Perhaps you want to have a conversation briefly in answer to that. Mr. Todd, is that the gentleman, the bigger guy? Yes. And then the defendant interjects himself. He looks like a guy from Renton High School. I don't know. It may be him. It just kind of looked like him. And then the court says, I'm sorry, I missed that first part. He says, he looked like someone I knew from high school. I don't know if it's him or not. He just looks similar. And then Mr. Todd says, he's presumably looking at his biographical information, notes his age, and says, well, it looks like he's 28 as well. And then the court says, I didn't notice that the recognition might be mutual. I just wanted to inquire. And then Mr. Todd, defense counsel, says, and if I may, Your Honor, what did juror 35 say? And the court says juror 35 was the gentleman who had talked about some various issues. And the defense counsel says, with regard to knowing Mr. Fastrup, he thinks that the juror has told the bailiff that he knows Mr. Fastrup, the defendant. He doesn't have any idea what the court's talking about. He thinks at that point in time that the juror has brought this up and that there's some recognition. So if there had, in fact, been a conversation between Mr. Fastrup and his lawyer at the time saying, hey, I think I know that guy, or whatever was said that the bailiff overheard, You'd think that counsel would know what the court was talking about when it was brought up, but it was pretty clear that he didn't. So the contemporaneous record lends support to the idea that there was no conversation. The court specifically says nonverbal recognition. That means nothing spoken. So I don't think the record supports any sort of a claim of error here. Moving on, unless the court has questions about that issue, moving on to the prior bad acts or 404B evidence, there were three instances that of prior bad acts to the defendant that essentially were elicited by the state. One was actually requested by the defendant himself pretrial to bring up, and that was the incident where the co-defendant broke out the windshield of the victim just 3 or 4 weeks before the murder happened. And the defense counsel tells the court, I want to talk about that because, you know, this co-defendant was also guilty of murder. She pled guilty to murder in the second degree. It was his theory of the case that she had murdered the victim by herself and was trying to frame the defendant because he had left her for the victim. So he says, I want to bring up this incident of her breaking out the windshield with a hammer of the victim to show how angry and jealous she is of this woman. And the state says, I can't properly object to that. I think that's relevant. I think that comes in. So when the state is examining the co-defendant, who has already pled guilty, he asks her about that incident, and he says specifically, let's talk about the damage to the car that you did. And his specific words are, did you do some sort of damage to the victim's car? Tell us about that. And then she answers with this, her reasons for why she did it. Well, the defendant beat me, pistol whipped me, and stole my cell phone. I was mad at him, and when the girlfriend shows up, I broke out the window because I want my phone back. He didn't ask her to elaborate. He said, what happened with the damage to the vehicle? He's trying to lead her back to the damage to the vehicle and not to get into this extraneous stuff. But then on cross-examination, defense counsel goes back to it repeatedly and tries to get her to alter her explanation for why she broke the windshield to be that she's angry and jealous at the defendant for leaving her for this victim. So that was one instance that was brought up by the state. The other two were ruled on by the court prior to the state eliciting them. A balancing test was done, and the court found that it was admissible based on the record. So all of the other incidents that this witness talked about, the prior bad acts of the defendant, were elicited by the defense counsel himself on cross-examination of this woman, who his entire theory of the case was is that she's violent, she's angry, she killed the woman by herself, the victim, because she was jealous and angry, and then she's trying to frame the defendant. So every time, this witness was uncontrollable. I think everybody agrees that no one in the courtroom could control this witness. And every time he would ask her questions, she would blurt out something else that he had done bad to her in the past. He didn't object to most of it. And if you think about it, there's a good reason he didn't object to it, because this is his theory of his case. This woman is crazy. She's angry. She's bitter. She's very upset. He used all of that in his closing argument to his advantage to argue specifically that she was mad and she was framing the defendant for this crime. So the fact that he didn't object, he never asked for the statements to be stricken, he didn't ask for a mistrial, is very telling. This is evidence that he probably wanted in, and the best way to get her to be quiet about it and stop talking about it was to sit down and stop cross-examining her. But he pressed her repeatedly, no, you're not mad at him for beating you in the past, you're mad at him because he left you for this woman. The only other issue in the case is the prior consistent statements of Ms. Backstrom, the co-defendant, that came in to rebut the expressly implied claim that she had 2 years to concoct the story between the time of her arrest and the time of her plea bargain and agreement to testify against the defendant. He argued essentially over and over again, you've had 2 years to think of this story, you're mad at him, you want to frame him. That was the reason why the prosecutor was allowed by the court to elicit her prior consistent statements to the police about the crime before the plea bargain even became a foreseeable consequence of what was going on. If you don't have any further questions, I'll sit down and ask the court to affirm.
All right.
Just actually, I wanted to point out on that sort of that windshield incident. Before trial, there was a discussion based upon the defense attorney's desire to offer evidence of Ms. Backstrom's conduct towards someone named Amanda. And on the part of the transcript that the state cites, which is on page 110 to 117 of the first volume, they're discussing about evidence about her and then about something that Ms. Grisby's mother might testify to, but they're not talking about cross-examining Ms. Backstrom or questioning Ms. Backstrom herself about this windshield incident. They're talking about what other people could talk about other things that Ms. Backstrom had done. So the prosecutor never said, we're going to introduce this windshield incident, which is an uncharged bad act. In fact, Mr. Fassler was being separately prosecuted for his conduct there. And never made that record and never had the court go through the mandatory ER 404B analysis, which is part of the argument that we're making here that was necessary and wasn't done. And it was indeed one of the very first things that the state elicited from Ms. Backstrom at the very beginning on page 9 of the transcript of her testimony. So that wasn't an invited error, and that wasn't something that Mr. Fassler first brought out and the state rebutted with. And then the state, in their rebuttal of a redirect of Ms. Backstrom, brought in a photograph to corroborate how she looked when Mr. Fassler pistol-whipped her during this uncharged windshield incident. Which is one of the things that we considered together was very prejudicial, more than it was probative, and shouldn't have come in. And then the limiting instruction, which Mr. Todd crafted for the court, but was during discussion trying to explain why the court was admitting this evidence and the jail guard's testimony, as well as Mr. Fassler making a purported threat about Ms. Backstrom. He was not trying to persuade the jury they should use this evidence for a certain purpose, but was trying to explain how the judge had ruled, which ultimately resulted in a comment on the evidence about how the jury should consider that. And the judge does have an independent obligation and duty to properly instruct the jury both on 404B evidence and its limited purpose and on how they take evidence in general from the case, and that the value should be determined by the jury and not by the judge. That said, if there are no further questions, we would ask you to reverse for the reasons we say in our briefing. Thank you.
Okay, our next case this morning will be Hopkins versus Seattle Public School District.